Welcome to Bella Studio.
Art.
Music.
Wine.
Music.
Spirit.
Incredible.
Love.
Experience.
Music.
Thank you for tuning into Artsy's Diner Radio, the voice of artsysdiner.com. And now, our feature presentation.
Thank you for joining Artsy's Diner Radio Network, the voice of artsysdiner.com. Artsy's Diner Radio Network brings you musicians, artists, authors, thinkers, dreamers from all over the world. Artsy's Diner is that special little virtual diner now going on its sixth year. Like a fine wine, it is getting better with time. So pull up a chair. Grab that favorite beverage, sit back, and enjoy the show. Artsy's Diner, changing the world, one song at a time, one heart at a time. And now, the host of our show. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to Artsy's Diner Radio. And yes, I am the host of the show, Mary. And I'll be joined tonight by Patrick Blessinger. We are very excited about bringing you tonight's show, and the topic is, you know, global learning communities. It is definitely something we all need to be thinking about, and after teaching my students geography and world history in the past week, I am more convinced than ever that we definitely need to be forging the pathway to connecting our kids, our next generation, with a truly global understanding. And in keeping with the theme of that, this entire week is Global Cooperation Week. Tomorrow is Global Cooperation Day, an endeavor through ForestNation.com. And anybody who's been listening to me all week knows that I keep talking about Global Cooperation Day, Global Cooperation Day. Well, I will fill you in a little bit more as the show goes on, but I just want to take just a moment and play the beautiful song that Michelle Qureshi, coming to us from Carmel, Indiana, has dedicated to this week. And it is a beautiful song. Just back, imagine yourself walking through the beautiful forests of the world again each day. Your contribution to the Week in Global Cooperation. If you are wanting to know more after the show, please go to forestnation.com/global-cooperation-day, and you can find out more about it. And go to your local nursery, grab a tree, and plant it in honor of the day tomorrow. More on that soon. And so tonight, joining me He is Patrick Blessinger. He's a global leader and recognized expert, Fulbright Scholar, Governor's Teaching Fellow in Education, Learning, and Instruction. Patrick is founder and executive director, CEO of the International HEDL Association, co-founder and co-director of the Institute for Meaning-Centered Education. And so tonight's topic, and if you want to know more about tonight's topic, I've actually posted two of the links to two articles dealing with tonight's topic, and that is building a global learning community. So much is talked about. I'm looking forward to talking to Patrick. Hello, Patrick.
Yeah, hello, Mary. How you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Can you hear me okay?
I can. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're coming through fine.
Excellent. Yeah, we've had a little bit of crackles. We've got a storm coming through here right now. So, you know, hopefully there won't be too many disruptions, but we'll pinch hit, y'all. I'm so excited about tonight's topic. It's very timely, isn't it?
Yes, yes. So, you know, the nice thing about the time that we're living in right now, 2013, is that there are so many technologies available, like the one we're on right now with Blog Talk Radio, with Skype, all these technologies that are all web-based technologies that leverage sort of the global interconnectedness nature of the internet, allow us to interconnect and communicate with each other regardless of where we're at. So I'm in New York City, you're in Indiana, and I'm sure our viewers are from, you know, the U.S. and Canada and other places all over the world, and yet we can come together rather seamlessly and talk and connect all in real time like we're doing right now. And so these tools have created a wonderful opportunity for us as educators to come together no matter where we're at in the world. And so part of the work that I'm doing as an educator and yourself with this program and the other work that you're doing is to figure out how to utilize and how to leverage the best aspects of these technologies to bring people together. And realizing that in doing so, the technology fundamentally is a tool. You know, there's nothing really magical about the technology itself. It's a tool. It enables us to, it's an enabler that enables us to achieve a certain outcome that we're trying to reach or a certain vision that we're trying to fulfill. And, the nice thing about where we're at in the evolution and the development of these technologies is the social nature of these technologies. We hear a lot about Web 2.0. Actually, we've heard a lot about Web 2.0 for the last several years, and we're right in the middle of it, right in the thick of Web 2.0 technologies. And so when the web first rolled out in the early 90s, actually the internet itself, which is sort of the different from the web is like the graphical user interface that sits on top of the internet. So the web is like the windows to the internet. The underlying technology, all the machinery that makes it all work, is called the internet, and that's actually been around since 1969. Started by an agency called DARPA from the federal government that funded a project, the Defense Agency Research Project Agency, that funded the project to figure out how do we interconnect researchers at major universities in the U.S. And so that's sort of planted the seeds of the internet. They go all the way back to 1969. And so it just developed further and further, and the protocols developed further. Really wasn't until the late 80s, early 90s, actually late 1980s, when the web itself, the protocol for the web, which was developed by Tim Berners-Lee, I believe, and with the HTTP protocol, But it wasn't until the mid-90s, I would say, or early 90s, 95, when Netscape came out with their browser, that it actually started to become popular with the average person and start to reach a critical mass. So just look how far we've come since 1995, when the first popular browser was made available. And now, just not even 20 years later, it's evolved to the point where we have an unbelievable mix of different technologies for almost every purpose one can imagine. And so when, and I've been an educator for 15 years now, and but in 2010, when I started HEDL, that was just less than 4 years ago, I realized that I could sort of see or had a vision of where things were going, or some of the emerging trends, anyhow, in education at all levels. But, you know, my primary focus early on was in the higher education space, simply because that's where I operated and where I taught for many years. And but I saw with the development of these new social technologies, what we call Web 2.0, that there was tremendous potential there for us to use them, for educational purposes and for learning purposes. And so that's where it all started. And so, you know, I went through the the rigorous sort of painstaking process of doing just some nitty-gritty research and analysis to try to figure out which tools, because there were so many of them, and they're growing exponentially, you know, the number of tools that are available to us today. Back in 2010, I did a lot of research and analysis for a couple of months to figure out which tools would be the best that would allow me to leverage what I wanted to, what I had envisioned for a global learning community. And then in the process of doing that, I discovered some things and put together a plan of how to implement that. And unfortunately, I made some good decisions along the way. But more importantly than that, even, is that I involved the right people. So that I realized early on that this is not something, that the vision that I had was not something that I could do alone, nor did I want to do it alone, that the only possible way to achieve the vision that I had of improving teaching and learning and advancing the scholarship and the practice of teaching and learning was to bring together educators and to have that collective intelligence, to be able to tap into that collective intelligence by bringing people together, bringing educators together and scholars together, and have a dialogue about how we can best achieve that. And so that's what we've been doing for almost 4 years now. And you know, it's grown exponentially, the different platforms that we're on. And that's good. And that, you know, gives me hope that people deep down, even though they may not express it in the most articulate way, even though they may not be seemingly as engaged as maybe we would hope that they would be, that I think deep down people, most people, really do want change. They want positive change, not just any change, but the positive change. They want to make a difference. It's just that, you know, sometimes the pressures of life and the pressures of our work lives, our professional lives, just our personal lives, you know, our health and our professional goals and aspirations and our personal goals and aspirations. You know, we live in a world that's very that has a lot of pressures, and sometimes we are just not sure how to do that, you know.
Right.
And I think a lot of people may even feel powerless in the you know, with a lot of the obstacles and barriers that oftentimes we're confronted with. And so, you know, I try to have, you know, a very understanding attitude about all that. I understand that, you know, we all have to deal with the human condition wherever we're at in our own way, and we're all struggling to live the best, you know, type of lives that we can, to raise our families, our children, and to get the most out and to just make our life meaningful, you know. And
yeah.
You know, when you strip it all away, that's fundamentally what it's all about, what everyone is striving for, is to reach a fulfilling, meaningful life. But oftentimes, you know, we're just not sure how to go about that.
Well, one of the things that I'm most concerned about, and I agree with you 100%, we are moving into this age where, you know, we have so many opportunities, you know, and it's, I keep going back to this one thing that I'm the most concerned about, and that is, you know, in 2002, when I went back in for my second degree, I went for my master's in curriculum and instruction, and it was based on problem-based integration. There was a huge component, everything we did. I mean, I started writing web quests and technology, I mean, right out of college. And so over 13 years ago, I was told then that this is going to be the norm, and every teacher needed to be able to do information technology integration. We needed to bridge the world and, you know, bring the world into our classrooms. And I really took that very seriously. And I have committed a great deal of my life to that. But sadly, I've talked to numerous teachers from all over the world, or I mean all over the United States, who have said the same frustrations. Are the average kid, 50% of the kids that we are encountering do not have internet access at home, or they do not have access to the computers. Now, mom might have a laptop, but mom won't let them do their homework on it. Or, you know, I started this radio show, a special show just for my students, to extend out the lesson, kind of review the test, focus in on what are the common core components, bringing the kids in. I've talked with people around the world who said they would love to talk to my students, do an interview, the whole nine yards. Well, there's a couple of things that's wrong with that. The majority of my students cannot access it, cannot access what we're doing right now. And, you know, and then the other thing is our schools, we unfortunately do not have an adequate enough system that they can even listen to it during a computer time.
Mm-hmm.
So as we are in continuing to see this, you know, we have this belief system that our kids are born into this tech-savvy understanding. And I've discovered not even just our younger kids, but a lot of our college kids, they still have to travel to the computer lab. They still, you know, so how do we focus at the same time that we are building up the importance and integrating global learning communities? How do we also begin to manifest the change and say once and for all that a computer, whether it's a tablet or a PC, whatever, and internet in the homes of every child, every kid who is at least in high school, is as important as paper and pencil were in 1965. How do we move to that so that we really make it fair? Because right now, my students are seeing unfold before their eyes the haves and the have-nots in a way that is actually diminishing their right to do exactly what you and I both know is truly the way to break down the xenophobia and to break down this lack of understanding about how we all fit together in this wonderful, beautiful global puzzle.
Well, I mean, that's a tough one because I think your assessment is spot on. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, the when we talk about the haves and the have-nots, you know, I think most people assume we're talking about the economic haves and have-nots, which is also, you know, a very important issue and critical problem, you know, in the world. But there's also the digital haves and have-nots, you know. And there are those who have access to technology, a basic computer, and access to the internet, and the prices on these things have fallen so dramatically that you know, anyone can get a full scale, you know, laptop now for just a few hundred dollars, you know, and access to the internet for, you know, just $10, $15 a month. But yet there are those that even having that, you know, is a major problem. And, mm-hmm. And that's very unfortunate because that isolates them from what's going on in the world today. You know, we talk so much about, you know, the whole focus right now with educational reform and with the Common Core standards at the K-12 level is college and career readiness. So that's mm-hmm. That's the mantra, you know, college and career ready. Everything has to be oriented around, you know, preparing students as they go from one grade to the next and hit high school to be college and career ready. But, you know, that implies that that's within the context of today's world that we live in. And today's world is very digital in nature and is only becoming more so as every day passes. And so it would seem to me that it would only make sense and is logical that to be college and career ready, one also needs to be fully have digital literacies.
Exactly.
And be competent to work with technology, you know, especially information technology, and especially communications and social technologies. Because I don't, you know, I know very few organizations that that you can perform your job and be considered competent if you don't even know how to use, you know, the computer or the internet or send emails. In fact, most of what I do, I mean, this has been when I came out of college back in the early 90s, my degree was in this area. You know, I decided when I went to college in the late 80s, the web had not, the web had not been available yet because mm-hmm. that didn't come about until I think 89 or thereabouts. We had just the first, wasn't even really hardly on the radar screen. We had a few initiatives, I think at the University of Illinois, that developed a browser, was a menu-driven browser. I think it was called Mosaic. But it wasn't until, you know, HTTP protocol was developed that we finally had the language in order to create the web graphical interface. And it really wasn't until 94, 95, the first commercially available web browser was available to people. But when I was going through college in the late 90s, companies were installing local area networks. You know, Ethernet was the big thing, you know, back then, and Token Ring and those sorts of things. But I could sort of see the writing on the wall, you know, and I just had this intuitive sense that, you know, the society was going to become more and more technology-based, and information and knowledge based. And although I couldn't envision, you know, how fast things would develop through the 90s and the 2000s, I realized that information technology was where things were headed and was going to be a major factor in jobs and the economy. And so that's what I decided to major in as an undergraduate. And then when I graduated in 92 from Auburn University with my degree in information technology and management, the first job I had, in fact, was with a high-tech startup company in Atlanta, developing information technology systems and business automation systems for companies. And then within a few years, it just exploded. And probably the major thing was the Telecom Act of 1996 that attempted to deregulate the telecommunications industry and the cable industry, and that opened up doors of opportunity for all these technologies, and things just exploded once Congress passed the act and decided to that it was time that we deregulate the telecom industry, and it opened up markets and opportunities for entrepreneurs. The whole field just exploded, and the web, as a result, got developed very fast at that point. So this is the world we live in. You know, we live in a digital world, you know, mm-hmm. and it is what it is. And it does no good for anyone, you know, to sort of deny that reality or bemoan, you know, whatever shortcomings or problems, you know, there may be with
right.
That reality or with, you know, technology. And I think so, you know, to go back to your original question, I think ultimately, and we discussed this on, you know, our first few talks together months ago, that it requires a mind shift, you know, in people, because there are embedded belief systems about, you know, technology and its use and, you know, the role it should play in education, and especially in K-12 education, especially in the earlier grades. And, it may not be an easy thing to make that mind shift, you know, in seeing, you know, the benefits that being fully digitally competent and having being digitally literate, how important that is in today's world, you know. And this doesn't, the fact that, you know, that I'm a proponent of digital literacy and new media literacy, especially, does not diminish or minimize in any way, shape, or form, you know, other literacies.
Absolutely.
It's just that we live in a world where the world, in one sense, is becoming more complex, and so we have to add, you know, be more multifaceted in our literacies and what defines a literate person today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just the ability to read and write, but of course that's, you know, basic and that's important, but it goes way beyond that also, you know. And the fact of the matter is we live in a digital world. You know, it is what it is. So I just think we have to embrace that reality and then figure out, okay, how do we create a learning environment that, in addition to all the other things that we're doing, that is also technology rich and that really embeds the proper use of technology in everything that we're doing as educators, so that students and teachers also start to develop those digital literacy knowledge and skills.
Well, I think one of the things that really concerned me, and I think this is where we've gotten off track in our school systems, is that there is this tendency to only allow into the network, if you will, those programs that have got, they have a publisher's name attached to them. And so it's a lot of bells and whistles. Everything is prescribed. Everything is set right there. And it doesn't, it, so there's this false notion. Now, that's fine for kindergarten. It's fine for supplemental. It's fine for whatever. But it's not what global learning is about. And there's a big difference between, you know, giving your kids some set programs they can go to and allowing them to access the better parts of the world. And, you know, it concerns me that you know, we see, let me rephrase, this is an opportunity for us to extend on a total different level our students' understanding of each other. There's this belief system by our kids that, and after talking with kids all this week, we've been really focusing on, you know, the how the United States of America aligns itself with the rest of the world. And the attitudes of our students were, of my students, was really quite remarkable as they started to explain who are Americans and why are certain things the way they are. And the misconception of our students was so, I mean, they were so negative about who we are as Americans, I was shocked. And part of it is because they don't understand what it is to be human beings in a global context. So in other words, you know, you mean there are kids who like this kind of music in Africa? Do you mean there are people who think, you know, you mean teenagers have problems in Russia? You mean there are families that can't feed their families, or there are kids who don't want to go to school because they'd rather stay at home and listen to their music? These are the kind of things that I think is the wonderful opportunity for us to, you know, eliminate some of those misconceptions and even fear about the rest of the world and how we all are really so integrated. And I was, the shocking moment came when we were talking about a recent crime spree in Chicago. And being only 60 minutes from Chicago, you know, I mean, I go to Chicago all the time. I used to live there. These types of things concern me. And we were talking about it, and this one little girl finally said, "I am so sick to death of hearing about Chicago. They have nothing to do with me. It has nothing to do with who we are here. So why are we talking about it?" And so I set out, it became my commitment of the week, to prove to them that we are all in fact connected, that it does matter. And so today it was really, we did this wonderful exercise, and I would love for them, and I do hope it'll happen, they will be able to extend outward and begin to communicate with people from around the world as we move into different areas of the world, so that they can begin to grab, you know, face to face in so many ways. You know, after a while, it's as if you and I are face to face. You know, and really, after a few minutes, it's like we forget that, oh, we're not really talking on the phone. This is something better, and that type of thing. So what I would love for you to really spend time with is the work that you did in this, I just completely lost track of what I was going to say, about the dialogue that you had. There was a program that you started working with in the global virtual learning environments. There was some work that you did on that in one of your articles. I'd love to have you talk about more.
Yeah, well, the you know, the I think our the world, you know, Thomas Friedman wrote that the book The World Is Flat, and that was a
right.
huge bestseller. And you know, in I think he's spot on in the sense that, of course, the world is flat metaphorically, and because the world keeps getting, in a real sense even, keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller, because we have all the technologies now, they're fully developed. Now I realize that, you know, in some, there are some countries and some places and in some countries that where, you know, the infrastructure is not very well developed, and a lot of people still do not have access to the internet or basic technologies. But the for a lot of people, you know, in the U.S., Canada, most countries, I think, this is, you know, in a lot of countries, they're even bypassing traditional telecommunication infrastructures. In the U.S., we had to, you know, going back to the late 1800s when the telephone system was first developed, we had to run wire everywhere, you know, copper wire, millions and millions of miles of it. But countries now, you know, don't have to go through that same process because we have wireless technologies and, you know, they can go straight to using the current technology and setting up their infrastructures. But be that as it may, the you know, to put that in the context of your question and learning environments, you know, we have a technology now that will allow us as educators to connect classrooms, you know, in one country with another country or with multiple classrooms, even using something as straightforward and as basic as Skype can accomplish that, you know, and Skype, you know, it's free to use. If you want to make long distance calls, of course, it's you got to pay a few pennies a minute. But as far as technologies are concerned, that's, you know, a simple example of a technology that that is available to everyone, you know, whether in the U.S., Canada, Europe, Russia, China, you know, doesn't matter. So these are universal technologies that you know, most classrooms have access to. So, you know, I'm one that, even though I'm a proponent of being of digital technologies and creating a learning environment that is digitally rich and technology rich, and creating students and developing students that are digitally competent and have these new media literacies, because that's just the reality of the world we live in. And if we are claiming that we want to make them college and career ready, or even if you're a more sort of, I guess, maybe progressive in your view as an educator, want to make your students global citizens and to think outside, you know, the confines of the classroom walls, or think more globally and outside even your own community or your own country, and think more globally, then these technologies are the tools that, and they're one tool, you know, but I think they're very important, can be an important tool if they're used properly. These can be very important tools that allow us to do that. But, you know, as we were discussing a few minutes ago, there are barriers, you know, and some classrooms, some schools, some school districts are maybe not as inclined to, you know, to want to embrace this for whatever reasons, maybe political mm-hmm. reasons, maybe financial reasons, or it just may be a mindset that doesn't believe in the value of doing this. You know, maybe they're very traditional, for lack of a better word, you know, in their mindset, and believe that, you know, we should just be focusing on the basic three R's, reading, writing, and math, and let's do things the traditional way. And, you know, we've been doing that for 100 years, and, you know, let's, you know, continue to do it. But, you know, we live in a totally, you know, from my view, is education is also about, and learning is also about being able to, you know, to function competently and fully, you know, in today's world, you know, which is vastly different, vastly, vastly different in so many levels and so many respects than even 10 or 20 years ago, let alone 100 years ago. And so, you know, I've worked with, I mean, as educators, you know, we can use these technologies. But the problem is I understand that in not only in K-12, but maybe even in the higher ed level, you know, because one of the benefits that I have of, you know, leading this organization that I lead, the Higher Education Teaching and Learning Association, and being involved in hundreds of discussions that go on every month with thousands of educators from all over the world, is I get real-time insights into what the issues and problems and successes are that are occurring right now, and what the beliefs and the attitudes and the mindsets are of educators, you know, from around the world. And I understand that, you know, in some situations, in some environments, because of, you know, a certain policy that may be in place or whatever, that it just may not be, you know, they're just not able to maybe do that in a way that that we know that they would like to do, you know, in connecting classrooms, you know. So, you know, you can, I know one example, I work with educators all over the world. One of the educators I work with, who you know because she co-edited the book with me on meaning-centered education, Olga Kobazyuk in Russia, who's from Khabarovsk, Russia, but now lives in Europe. But we were involved in a project where her class in Russia was connected to another university class at Stanford. And so her university class in Khabarovsk, Russia, which is the far east of Russia. That's as far east as you can go, and it's right on the Russian-China border, not too far from Japan, actually. And
wow.
But yet they connected with she collaborated with a professor at Stanford, and they agreed to have a global basically to set up a global learning community for their particular course on politics and culture. And so they met regularly. So the professors communicated, they decided the framework of how this should work, and the benefits were obvious. You have students in the U.S. Who are now connected with and communicating with students in Russia who have fundamentally different experiences, you know, growing up, different political environments, different economic environments, et cetera. And, but yet, at the core, they're still human beings. We're all human beings. So we have a common humanity, and that's what binds us together fundamentally. But they collaborated and set up this course and had a project that ran through the entire course that the students worked on collaboratively, so the U.S.-Russian joint project, if you will, and they would get together periodically throughout the course to communicate. And so they had a video conference set up where they would get together periodically and communicate and talk with each other and have dialogue and try to understand, you know, the different cultures, the U.S. culture and the Russian culture. And they looked at, and one of the concrete things that they did was analyze as a group from both the Russian perspective and the U.S. perspective, analyze the different leadership styles of Barack Obama and Putin, who is their Russian president. And so this has, you know, tremendous value, because rather than just reading about, you know, Russian culture and Russian presidential leadership styles from a textbook, okay, the students are actually engaged face-to-face, you know, and communicating with each other. And that has so many benefits beyond, you know, what one can learn, you know, simply from a textbook.
Yeah,
and so we have these technologies. They're available. We just have to learn as educators, because it has to start with educators, because we're the instructional leaders, okay? And we have to, and the whole idea of leadership is that, you know, we have vision and that we're taking the lead. And that we can see the value and the benefit of doing this, and we proactively, you know, decide to put this in place and put this in practice. And then as leaders, we guide the students, you know, through the process.
It's pretty impressive. It's just, you know, when you stop and you think about what we can provide for each other, and, you know, it's whether you're talking about, you know, K through 12, or you're talking about higher education, or even just continuing education. I mean, there is this huge movement now that is, you know, calling upon a major change. We're not talking about, you know, there are those who are saying we're past the point of reform, and the idea of reform coming from the public school systems in and of itself, whether it's here or, you know, the traditional educational norms, are losing ground in so many regards. And, you know, how do, you know, taking different models throughout the United States, and not even educational models, but just an overall economic model, and saying, you know, we've helped to educate and spread this idea of education around the world. We have, in so many regards, and of course we've borrowed from other educational processes as well. But are we to the point of, you know, are we talking about a transformation in education, or, you know, I mean, is this just the beginning of what we're going to see dynamic changes within 10 to 15 years, and our understanding of what, you know, readying the 21st century learner, instead of going to school for 4 years, for example, it becomes more skill and task based. I know there's been some suggestion of that, and, you know, and I see that through this is a wonderful opportunity for myself, for example. What better way to study Russian literature than to literally be connected with Russia and Russian professors and students and
exactly.
Reading it from there, instead of going to, you know, the University of Illinois, which is a wonderful school, don't get me wrong, but going there and being, you know, filling up my days with so much extraneous. It's like, you know, I asked my students, I said, what would your school day look like if once you get into high school, you literally start practicing at being what you want to be as an adult?
Mm-hmm.
Your career, what would your school day look like? And they just they said, what? And I said, really, what would your school day look like? What do you want to be? What are you interested in? Somebody said, I want to be a photographer. I said, okay, how would you design your school day? You got to be at school all day because that's your job. This is your internship, you know.
Yeah.
How would you study all of the most important subjects, and how would you make it look? And it was amazing to hear these kids talking. Well, we would study the science of, you know, of the chemistry of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. We would, you know, and the light, the study of light, that, you know, and they went through and they filled up an entire day. That's problem-based learning. And that's also, and the global connectedness to say, okay, now, these are all the tasks you must accomplish in a day. And you can use all the resources in the world in order to make them happen. And it's all at your fingertips. Will you do it? Can you do it? Oh, absolutely. I would love it, Ms. Luluna. I would be here every day. There'd be no question what I would be doing. And, you know, and I told them, we were talking, I said, if in doubt, if you can't find the answer, then go to Google. Type it in. Somebody has the answer out there. And they, and I was shocked at how many of them have told me that they have been indoctrinated by other teachers that it is wrong to Google it. And I think, and I started laughing. I said, I got through my second master's Googling it. You know, I mean, do we do that? Right. I mean, it's like when I'm talking with Steve about a new idea or, you know, how to make something work. I can't figure out how to flip something to, I was trying to make a video and I said, I can't get this to work. And he said, well, Mary, Google it. Somebody out there has had the same problem and knows how to do this. And so, you know, so even software developers are Googling it to find out how to learn Perl and learn a new process.
It's exactly. Yeah.
But
that's
we,
collective learning, you know.
Exactly.
Because the web is like, you know, the digital library, you know, the library of the digital age, you know, there's a wealth of information out there. Of course, it's not all, you know, some of the information is higher quality than other information, but that's why we have to use our critical thinking, you know, as people and as learners, and our refined judgment and discernment to wade through all of that. And to use and apply it, you know, in a way that benefits us and makes sense for us. But I, you know, I'm on the internet, the web all day because that's the nature of my job. You know, probably 95% of what I do takes place over the web. You know, and so that's the point we've gotten to in the digital world that we live in, you know, and it is what it is. It's the reality of today's world. And so, you know, and I keep going back to what I mentioned earlier. I mean, if we're serious about making, you know, in the context of educational reform today, if we're serious about making students college and career ready, which is the mantra, you know, of the current educational reform movement, then, you know, I think that has to, you know, include making students comfortable and savvy and experts in operating and navigating throughout this wonderful, you know, digital world that exists today, you know.
Absolutely. And, well, there's still so much fear. I think that there are still so many adults, parents too, that, you know, there's this stigma that a young person on the internet is going to get in trouble. There's this almost this fear and there's a loss of control. And so are we preparing our students to be proactive learners and engaged learners if we're telling them the only place you're going to get the interview or the information is from that textbook? Or the hand, or what are the PowerPoints that I provide you? Instead, it's setting them up to, you know, we really have this beautiful, wonderful opportunity to become fully engaged. I mean, in so many ways,
exactly.
You know, it's the way Abraham Lincoln taught himself.
Yeah.
It is. And it's a guided self-learning almost.
Yeah, I think one of the, from my perspective and based on learning theories, established learning theories that exist, and what we know about human learning and human psychology and psychopsychology of how people interact with each other, that, what we should be doing is creating more self-regulated learners. And you described earlier a great example of how to start heading down that road, how to start fostering an environment where students take more ownership of their own learning and become more self-regulated in their learning because they want to learn. Okay?
Exactly.
It's not something that is imposed on them or forced on them, or it's not something that is, so bureaucratized that, it's just something that, they have to do. But if we set up environments and the right conditions for effective learning environments, then, what we should be striving is to instill not just knowledge, although that's very important, but that's a minimum, knowledge about, all these different subject matters, math, physics, or chemistry, whatever, the humanities. That's minimum, not the maximum, or not even the expected, but a minimum, because that's, that was really one of the revolutionary insights of Bloom when he developed his taxonomy of learning objectives, is that, creating a knowledge base is at the lowest level of learning.
Exactly.
It's important. It's critically important, but it's a foundation. And we have to go way beyond just building a foundation and develop all these higher order learning skills as well. And part of doing that, what we discovered when we wrote the book, did the research for the Meaning-Centered Education and Learning book, is that, the best and most effective way to do that is to tap into one's own sense of what it means to have a meaningful life, tap into that person's aspirations for what he or she wants to become, as in life and as they get older and as they, envision their life as an adult, and there are schools that are doing this, in all over the place. One of them we talked about last time, a school in the UK, who's implemented a type of learning called negotiated learning that is doing exactly what you described earlier. They start their day with the students, and the students have a lot of autonomy in deciding, what they want to learn that day, and it's based on their own learning needs, the students' learning needs that come from the students and the parents, of course, also who are involved in it, especially in the earlier grades. But the whole idea is that you create a learner-centered environment, a learning-centered environment where you're focused on learning needs, and you make the and that really transforms the whole environment. And schools here and there all over the place are doing this, but at the same time you have other schools that are so locked into maybe old mindsets that resist change, and for whatever reason, whether they're political obstacles or barriers or just a belief system that is afraid maybe to embrace change and the reality of the new world that we live in, you know, and
exactly.
And that's unfortunate, you know, because learning school should be a place where learning is enjoyable, where learning is fun, where students and teachers really want to come, you know, are excited about coming to school because it has, you know, it's an environment that is meaningful to them and that that is enjoyable to them, that the learning that is going on is based on their own needs and their own desires of what they want to become. And if that is an environment where that's not going on, then I would say that is probably a very tough environment to work in.
Exactly. One of the things that I've really noticed with my students so far this year, because, you know, they came in and they're going, oh, yeah, geography, it's just another boring social studies class, whatever. And, you know, if I allow it to be nothing more than worksheets and moving through a textbook, they're going to be absolutely right. They're right to call it that. And the way that I see it is that they are capable of reading the textbook on their own. There are things that are important in there, so don't get me wrong. There are things in there that without a careful reading, there are important things that they're going to that we can't possibly cover in 45, 50 minutes every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's even less that when you get in all of the time commitments of people leaving class, etc. But the thing that I can provide them and that every teacher can provide our kids, their students in front of them, is a relationship of understanding, the opportunity to dialogue. If I can't let them dialogue with people from around the world and I can't bring in other professionals, then I can connect them through me. You know, I can connect them by dialogue and by getting them excited about current events and learning. And something happened even today, which was remarkable. I almost had to give up all the other plans that I had because they wanted to talk to me. They wanted to tell me all that they discovered the day before in the news. So for one class period, because I knew they were ready for what's going to happen tomorrow, that's what we spent, because what did I do? I allowed them to paraphrase, to articulate. They showed me comprehension skills. They showed me presentation skills. They met everything that is necessary, a good portion of them, in one class in particular. It was profound.
Yes.
They showed me exactly what is necessary if you are going to be in a business meeting, in a meeting where you need to have a professional sharing of ideas. They did
it. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And there was one young man.
Exactly.
Yep, there was one young man who has been kind of identified as, you know, on the fringe. You know, he's a fringe kid.
Yeah.
He has been so profoundly articulate every single day when we are talking about things happening in the world. After I went on this whole thing today about, you know, how the United States fits in with the rest of the world with regards to resources, et cetera.
Yeah.
And we started talking about, you know, is connecting it to the local governments. And all of a sudden he said, so in other words, Ms. LaLuna, and he went on this thing, and in 5 minutes, he created a verbal web which broke it all down, brought it all back together, and summarized it. And I called him up at the end of the class, and I said, I surely hope that you are going to be studying economics and or at least political science, because, I mean, it was unbelievable what this young man was capable of doing. But at the beginning of the school year, he was identified as, you know, well, he's going to be one. He doesn't really do any work. Thinking, he's mastered it. He can out-talk almost all, and he gets it.
Yeah.
The comprehension ability of that young man is so profound, but if I never let him talk, if I had never gotten it, I would never have known that.
And that's active learning. That's engaged learning. You know, it's moving away from this passive model, okay, where the, you know, the students just sit there and aren't even allowed to say anything or engage in any dialogue because, you know, the teacher is in complete control and maybe he or she, you know, doesn't want to give up that control for whatever reason. But it's actually flipping that, you know, on its head and saying, no, how do we, you know, the most effective learning, all the research shows this, and all the established learning theories are based on this fundamental, you know, premise that, you know, the most effective learning is learning when the person is engaged, you know, and is actively participating, you know, in the learning process, you know, through dialogue or through various learning activities or group activities, okay? And then to take that a step further, the most effective learning is learning where the learner, you know, has is learning those things that are of interest, you know, to him or her. So maybe a particular learner has, you know, an interest in politics or economics, okay? So create an environment and a structure and learning activities, okay, that fosters that, you know, and that taps into that. Because one of the, you know, the other things that makes for effective learning that we've learned as researchers is that learning is not just cognitive, okay? It's not just knowledge-based, and it's not just cognitive-based. It's also emotional and it's social. So learning, so the learning environment that we create in the classroom and outside the classroom, but, you know, especially in the classroom, since that is, you know, the sort of formalized learning structure that, we have today, you know, in schools, it needs to have an emotional component and it needs to have a social component. It needs to address the emotional and social needs of people. Because we're human beings. We're emotional by definition. We're social by definition, okay? And if we set up a system that ignores that or discounts that and or even tries to cut that off, then, you know, no wonder, you know, we may end up with misdiagnosing or mislabeling a particular learner as being, you know, well, he's not going to amount to anything, you know, because, you know, he doesn't fit the, you know, our expectation of, you know, how a learner is supposed to behave in our traditional, you know, sort of linear thinking, you know. But if we can break out, well, if we can shift our mindset, you know, and that's, I think, is the most difficult part. But shift our mindset and come to a just look at the science, look at the data, look at the research, you know, that says, you know, we need to educate the whole person, you know, not just one aspect of a person, you know. And if we do that, I think it really can have this integrative learning environment, this whole person that addresses the needs, the learning needs, cognitive, social, and emotional of the whole person. And I think it can have a transformative effect, you know.
Well,
on,
well, one of the other transformations that I saw today as a result of that, and you talk about, you just mentioned a key word, integrative, integration. What does that really mean when you're talking, and one of our earlier conversations, we're talking about the diversity in a learning environment. So today, there is a one young man in my classroom who is in the same class who is, he struggles. He's kind of, he's very withdrawn, very quiet, kind of the, you know, a fringe of a different kind, you know. And and the one young man, I called him up at the end and I said, and that's when I shared with him, I really hope, you know, that was very well done, very well stated. I really hope you're going to consider, you know, different fields and going into this and using your ability to talk. And he went to turn away, and another, and the second young man who never speaks, who kind of just is almost afraid of his own skin, he intentionally stayed behind. First of all, he knew that was a safe, now here's a safe moment. in front of an adult. He stopped the young man who was so articulate and just said, I just want you to know, I really think you're very smart. And the young man who, you know, has opened up and really shared these very complex concepts, looked at the other young man and said, hey, man, thanks a lot. And they here were two young men who were misfits. In that moment, found that, I've got chills when I think about what actually that meant and what that could mean for both young men. And that was a form of integration because they were two very diverse individuals. In that moment, they were in complete and total alignment, and they were able to see as young men, eye to eye, and in a way that was completely safe. There was and so we need to be encouraging more of that as well. So when we think about a holistic approach to educating our students is really what we're talking about. We're developing them to take on, you know, talk about career readiness. you have to be able to articulate to all people at all times and know how to communicate. And both of these young men, although they appeared to be not what you would think of, in that moment they were completely dead on. It was a classic moment. It really was.
Well, and that is a credit to you as a teacher, because as an instructional leader, part of being a leader, you know, is to create that safe environment, you know, because unless the learning environment is safe, and that is the main, you know, one of the main responsibilities of a teacher in the classroom is to set the tone of the environment in the classroom, and to structure it in such a way with the learning activities and the dialogue that is going on, that it's a safe environment. Because unless the students feel safe that they can, you know, dialogue and speak and start to claim their voice, start to, you know, have a voice and be actively engaged, you know, in the learning process, unless they feel that environment is safe, they're probably going to be very reluctant to want to, participate in that dialogue, you know. And so that's where leadership comes in. And that's why, you know, I feel very strongly that being a teacher is not just about being a content specialist, not just knowing the content of the subject. It's that at a minimum. You know, it's much more than just knowing, being knowledgeable of the content, because we're dealing with human beings, and human beings, you know, are multidimensional and are complex. And when you're dealing with a whole classroom of 20 or 30 of them with 20 or 30 different personalities, you know, et cetera, then that takes some very good leadership skills in order to facilitate a learning environment, you know, that that has an impact and that's effective, and so, you know, I really commend you for for exhibiting, you know, those sorts of leadership skills, because that's what we need in more teachers, and that's what we should be teaching in addition to just the content of the subject. In our education programs at the university level, students who are in university programs who want to become teachers, you know, in the K-12 level, or even, you know, and in the higher ed level too. So it, you know, there's no distinction there. You know, these principles are the same regardless of the level that we're talking about. You know, it takes instructional leadership. It takes understanding, people and the psychology of people and what makes people tick, and you know, how we function and how we learn, and then that requires development of good instructional leadership skills, you know. Like these examples that you've been given, they're great examples, you know. And I think what we're seeing in these examples is, a situation where the students are feeling more comfortable to engage, in the process, that they feel more comfortable because you've created an environment where that is so, where they feel safe. We should be tapping into and trying to understand what are students' talents and their interests, Unfortunately, we hear a lot about, and I think in some schools, we may even pressure students to go into particular career fields simply because that's where the jobs are,
Right.
We hear a lot about, you should go into engineering, for example, because, a lot of jobs there, go into computer programming because that's where the jobs are, whatever. But I've never understood that rationale. Why on earth would someone want to go into a field if he or she didn't like that field?
It also comes down to aptitude. That would be like saying,
exactly.
There's going to be a lot of people in the music industry. There's going to be a lot of jobs in the music industry, so you need to go into music. No. That's not how it works. There is a certain mindset and an approach to different types of careers. So if you're going to encourage people to go into engineering, then you need to start working with them, because the mind of an engineer is very different from the mind of, I can't even think right now off the top of my head. And engineering isn't just a job. It's a mindset. It is an approach it's approach to their everyday life. And if you have someone who's very disorganized and who doesn't look at the world logically, they're going to struggle. They will not make it past their first year in college. And then you've set them up, because what are you saying? So to identify early on, the number of people I've talked to who are musicians, for example, or who are writers, there was no plan B. They knew early on that this is what they were, this is where they were going to go, and this is what they wanted to do. And so... Mm-hmm. And so anybody, you don't steer, they're not going to let themselves be steered away from that. And so the same thing goes with all careers. It's very important.
Exactly. Yeah.
What is your natural rhythm? What is your natural approach to the world? Then you could probably, it would be easier to find something in that approach than you will by saying, you need to go here because this is the logical thing for me, according to you.
Exactly. You're spot on. We should not be saying, this is what you should be doing. What we should be doing is finding out what their aptitudes and what their interests are, and what they want to do.
Right.
If someone doesn't have the aptitude or the interest, say to be an engineer, we shouldn't be forcing them in that direction simply because they're at this point in history, there may be a lot of jobs in that area. That just seems to me a sort of a misguided, it's well-intentioned, but I think it's misguided, because ultimately every person has to do what is meaningful to him or her,
Exactly.
And that's based on what our individual aptitudes and talents are, our natural talents and our aptitudes, and it's based on what our interests are, our aspirations, what do we want to do, And, you gave a good example. You look at a lot of, successful people, and And a lot of them, you know, they are very sure about what they want to do because they have a passion for what they're doing and they feel a purpose in what they're doing, you know. And so nothing's going to stop them, you know, from doing that. And they will figure out a way, one way or another. They will use their creativity and their imagination, and they will figure out a way how to make a living from doing what they want to do. You know,
absolutely.
And we see that in every field. We see that in whether it's writing, or teaching, or entrepreneurs in the technology field, or in business, or in engineering. It doesn't matter. So, from my perspective, one of the fundamental purposes of schooling and of education in general is to assess, you know, each student, each learner as an individual, and to help him or her find out what their aptitudes are and to nurture those, to find out what their interests are and to nurture those, you know.
Absolutely.
And so that they begin, we put them on a road where they become more self-regulated learners and take more ownership of their own learning process, and they start to develop a purpose and a passion for learning. And when you get to that point, then I think the magic starts to happen, and I think they're, you know, once they get out of the formal schooling period, they will be much more capable of making the right decisions for them about what is meaningful, you know, in their lives. Because I can't, you know, decide what's meaningful for you any more than you can decide what's meaningful for me. You know, every individual
right.
has to learn that on his or her, you know, for him or herself, because we're all unique. We all have different personalities. We all have different aptitudes, different interests, and different aspirations. The
exactly.
schooling and the learning environment, if it's structured properly and we have instructional leaders and there's good leadership and we understand the science of learning and the research, then we're in a much better position to create an environment that fosters that in our students.
I also think that it's important in the promotion of society in so many ways. I mean, I think about the number of practitioners in every walk. That's why, I mean, I really do believe that what you are talking about comes down to the difference between a really good doctor and a really good diagnostician.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
And a doctor who maybe got straight A's in school but cannot see the forest for the trees. It
yeah.
comes down to what was the, were they, while you might be able to do really, really well academically, but if you don't have that instinctive, that intuitive nature to be a good mm-hmm. diagnostician, then you will only go by the book. And whether it could be in law, it could be, it doesn't matter. The best
mm-hmm.
practitioners in every field, it comes down to a matching of aptitude,
mm-hmm.
desire, intuitive nature, and it's really, we can do a great service to our kids if we help them hone in on that intuitive nature. That young man I talked to today,
mm-hmm.
he has an intuitive
yeah.
nature, and
yeah.
he is able, you know, and so whatever it is that he ends up doing, it is, that needs to be nurtured and fed and
mm-hmm.
encouraged. Because it comes so natural to him that
mm-hmm.
you know, it's really exciting, and that's where I think we can be doing in our classrooms, and that's one of the beauties, coming back to the original thing, in expanding out their knowledge base and
yeah.
allowing them to experience the world in so many
mm-hmm.
different ways. They begin to understand and connect with more people who maybe are even like them, and when you do it, that gets pulled out. So
exactly, yeah, yeah, you're spot on.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have tackled the world tonight. This is exciting. And
yeah,
we are all, it is, and we're almost out of time. So if you want to talk about and get people ready for our November visit, I would love for you to do that, because I know you have some things planned.
Well, refresh my memory, do you recall what our topic is?
I think Olga is going to be joining us, if I'm not mistaken. So I do know that. Let me go back to my notes real quick here. I know that that was the hope anyway, that she was going to be maybe joining us November 7th. And so I don't know. I guess we haven't really decided what the focus is going to be, except for, you know, your comrade is going to be joining us for sure. You know, and so between the two of you, I get to sit back and just listen.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly going to try to get Olga. I tried to get her on tonight's program, but she had a conflict, and so I'll make every attempt to get her on the next program for it's November. Yeah, so
yes.
That would be November 7th.
Right,
I believe. Yeah.
Well,
okay.
And I would love for you to also talk about, because I know you shared with me in the past, if you could talk about the conference that's coming up, the International Conference on Innovation and Education in July. I would love to spend some time talking about that and
mm-hmm.
find out, you know, what it's all about, and so that other educators who are listening can maybe, you know, tap into it, become involved in some regard. So, you know, I'd like to spend some time with that. But definitely, I'm already looking forward to November.
Well, I just pulled up my Google Calendar, and it says the topic is going to be creating meaningful learning environments.
There you go.
And yeah, so meaningful learning environments. So we'll talk more about what is meaningful learning and how to create those types of environments. I'll touch base with Olga and try to get her on the program, because she is she's an amazing lady. When I started this whole HEDL organization, and we were putting together going to turn it into a legal entity, a nonprofit association, because that was a logical next step in its development. And we were looking for a president of the association. Now, I'm the CEO, so I'm the founder and the executive director of the organization, and the executive director is just another title for the CEO. But in our particular structure, which is not uncommon, you know, for nonprofit educational associations, you have a CEO who handles sort of all the daily management and operations of the organization, and has the overall responsibility for the entire organization. But on the board of directors, you also have a position called the president, because the board of directors is the governing board of the association, and I'm the president and the CEO are co-chairs of this board of directors, which is our governing board. But anyhow, when I was looking for our first, you know, a person to serve as the first president, and the president of the association serves a one-year term, so every year we have a different president. And it's always an educator. It could be a professor, or it could be a dean, or it could be even a university president. And they serve one-year terms, and they help guide and direct. So I work very closely with them, and they provide input to guiding and directing the development of the association. But when I was looking at all the different educators that are within our community, our HEDL community, I was so impressed by Olga, and not just her background as an educator and her academic credentials, but much, much more than that. I was really impressed with her passion for education and her leadership abilities. And so I asked her to be the first president of the association. And and I'm very happy with that choice, and she served magnificently in that role. And since then, we've collaborated, have collaborated, and continue to collaborate on a number of different projects. The meeting-centered book was our first, you know, major collaboration. Also, I'll be going to St. Petersburg at the end of this month for a conference that she is helping to organize there with the Russian Academy of Education. And then you mentioned another conference that will that's coming up next, I think July of next year, that talks about innovation in education, which is also a very important topic. But so no shortage of topics to talk about, you know, on your program here.
Absolutely. Well, I'm looking forward to it, and I'm going to get off because the lightning is starting to strike here again. I'm hearing it coming through the microphone and earphones and stuff. But I will see you again on the 7th of November, and I look forward to it.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you, Patrick.
Bye-bye.
Have a great night. All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I know I've seen quite a few people that have been coming through in and out of the chat, and thank you so much for joining us tonight. I encourage you to link on the articles that are on tonight's show page, and you can find out more about the Global Education Partnership and what Patrick was talking about. And I encourage you to join us again tomorrow for Imagine You, Imagine Me, as we kick off and we celebrate the Global Cooperation Day, and you can go to forestnation.com and find out more about it. Find out how you can become a partner with forestnation.com and changing our world in a beautiful way. I'm going to say goodnight by playing for you the theme song for Imagine You, Imagine Me, and then we will sign off. We look forward to seeing you again. And if you have any ideas and topics for education that you would really like us to focus on, or maybe you would like to join us, you can drop me a line at artsysdiner@gmail.com. And just remember, imagine you and imagine me what we can do if we just pull it all together and change our world.
Imagine you. Imagine me. We can live in harmony. Imagine the forest, lush and green, swaying wild, swaying free. The hope and growth, it can be seen, stretching wild and stretching free. Come and dream it, come and see. Imagine you, imagine me. We can live in a harmony. Imagine you,
imagine you,
imagine me.
Imagine me. We can live
in harmony,
free harmony.
Imagine the forest,
imagine the forest,
lush and green,
lush and green,
swaying wild,
swaying wild,
swaying free. Forest, we all will play together, planting while we say, don't wait till tomorrow, plant today. We can change our world this way. Join the arbor joy display. Hey, imagine you,
imagine you,
imagine me,
imagine me.
We can live
in harmony.
lush and green,
so lush and green,
swaying wild,
swaying wild,
swaying free,
oh swaying free,
stretching wild,
stretching wild,
stretching free. Imagine you. Imagine me. We can live in harmony.
Thank you for stopping by Artie's Diner Radio, the voice of ArtiesDiner.com. Artie's Diner Radio is an Artie's production. Champagne and LaLuna production team featuring creator, executive producer Mary E. LaLuna, and Steve Champagne, producer, sound engineer, and artistic contributor.